It's 4:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up later, we'll look at the 9/11 Commission report released today on terrorism and national security and what the recommendations are going forward. But first, a national debate about the overuse of solitary confinement in state and federal prisons is just beginning to play out here in Wisconsin. A new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism raises questions about the effectiveness of keeping inmates in isolation for long periods of time. Gilman Halstead reports.
The report documents 6 cases in Wisconsin where guards pepper-sprayed or tasered inmates in segregation cells after they cut themselves with pieces of sharp metal or tried to attempt suicide by overdosing on medication or hanging themselves. But the report also quotes a letter from Waupun Prison Warden William Pollard saying changes have been made in segregation rules to ensure the health and well-being of inmates, including regular visits from medical staff. Former DOC Secretary Rick Ramish now heads the Colorado prison system, where he's making changes in the use of segregation to discipline inmates.
What I had done here was not only reviewing those that were in segregation, but examining why people were put there to begin with and was it really needed. And, of course, a portion of that was removing the mentally ill from administrative segregation.
Ramish decided that in some cases, segregation was making inmates' mental illnesses worse.
In a sense, we were holding people responsible for things that they didn't even really realize what they were doing because of their mental illness, and they were ending up in administrative segregation for very lengthy periods of time, and we put a stop to that practice.
Another former Wisconsin prison director, Walter Dickey, says any changes to the current use of segregation should include incentives for good behavior.
You ought to be in a sort of constant state of letting people earn their way out, and that you ought to be following the sort of philosophy that prison is as punishment, not for punishment, meaning we're not trying to make people suffer while they're there. We're restraining their autonomy and their freedom, and that's what prison is about.
That's a philosophy that the current state prison director, Ed Wall, shares. At a recent meeting of the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, he reassured members of a prison reform group that he's committed to making changes in the use of segregation.
We have some extremely violent people, but if you look outside of the United States to countries like Sweden and others that are where segregation is actually a very focused mental health and programming facility, that's really where I think that we need to head.
But the guards who work in segregation units aren't sure about the proposed changes to the system. Brian Cunningham heads the statewide Correctional Officers Union. He says the reforms are based on advice from people who have never worked as guards and don't understand why officers sometimes have to use force.
All these national experts, put the shirt on, come on down, get your hands dirty, get in a seg, have an inmate swing on you, and try to sit back and tell me, the outside observer, what you think.
Cunningham says it doesn't make sense to try to reform the prison system by only focusing on segregation and ignoring what's going on outside the prison.
Nationally, we want to cut every social program we have on the street. Are we going to make sure that these inmates have the things that they need on the street so that they don't come to prison in the first place? If we're only going to have this conversation about this little slice in the SAG building, it's a waste of time.
Members of a growing prison reform movement in the state are demanding more funds for social programs that keep people out of prison, but they say they'll keep pushing for reform of segregation inside the prison as well. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Joining us now to offer a closer look at how and why solitary confinement or segregation has been used in the state prison system, we have Walter Dickey with us. He's a law professor at the UW-Madison, and he's former secretary of the Department of Corrections. Walter, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So under the current system, under what circumstances would an inmate be put in segregation?
Well, there are a lot of circumstances that can lead to an inmate being in segregation. One is that they're there voluntarily, usually because they fear for their own safety, although there are some inmates who simply don't want to be part of the general population. I'd say, though, the dominant reason for people being in segregation is for infractions of prison rules that lead them to be sent to segregation, either adjustment segregation, which is a short period, or what's called program segregation, which charges, often for a much longer period. And then finally, there's a group in what's called administrative segregation. That's because they're believed to be dangerous to themselves or to others. They've usually had a lot of fairly violent episodes, and they're there because it's thought that they cannot safely be released into the general population.
Well, what is the impact of segregation on a criminal when they spend, especially not just those short periods of time, if they're there for a longer period of time?
Well, segregation is very difficult. I think a lot of people think it's a sort of bare cell with nothing in it. The dominant segregation in Wisconsin is what's called program segregation, where the inmates have all their belongings, all their books and the like, and even have access to television, electronics, and stuff like that. But it is obviously a situation in which they do not have a lot of contact with others. They will have contact with staff. They'll have rec every day for an hour or so. But by and large, it's very strictly limits contact with other prisoners.
Is it important to the safety of guards and maybe other inmates to have segregation as an option?
I think so. I think it's really not a question of whether to have it. I think it's really a question of how much it's used. I have little doubt, given my experience, that there are inmates who for periods of time cannot be in the general population. They've got to be in some more isolated and controlled environment because they behaved in ways that have led them to just be dangerous to others, to have acted out sort of repeatedly. Now, you know, that said, one question is what should the duration of that be? And obviously another question is, well, how many people actually need to be there? I think we're in a situation, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally, where mental illness is another dominant reason that people are there. When I said administrative segregation, dangerous to themselves or others, that's often associated with mental illness. And because of, in fact, mental institutions are sort of inaccessible to prison authorities, what you wind up doing, usually for the safety of the individual inmates themselves as well as the safety of others, is isolating people in segregation, which is far from ideal and runs a great risk of exacerbating their condition.
Let's turn to the guard side of this now. Yesterday we talked to Bill Leaders, who did that Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism report, talking about allegations made against the staff at the Waupun Correctional Institutions. The instances of abuse he wrote about took place in the prison segregation unit. Does that surprise you that we'd be hearing these stories, allegations of abuse in the segregation unit?
It doesn't surprise me that you'll be hearing stories about it. Again, I would not sort of rush to equate accusation with truth. You always have to get the facts, and that requires a sort of legitimate investigation. But leaving aside the sort of question of misbehavior by correctional officers or the like, realize these are extraordinarily difficult places to be and to work. They're loud, they're smelly, they're dangerous. You have inmates and guards getting at each other verbally, baiting going on inmate to inmate, inmate to correctional officer. And so I think I always thought it would test the best of us to be put in that kind of circumstance for any period of time and not be either instinctively or strongly tempted to react and to react physically. Now, again, I say that not knowing anything about the allegations, so I don't want to cast aspersions on either the inmates or the correctional officers, but just to sort of note the difficulty of the situation. It cannot bring out the best in anybody.
And because of those conditions, back when you were Department of Corrections Secretary, you wanted to change how guards are assigned to segregation units. What were you suggesting changed? Why didn't it happen?
I wanted a couple things to happen. One is I wanted to rotate people through SEG, that is staff members, because I thought having them work there for any period of time really led them to be jaded and led them to perhaps act in ways that are unprofessional, even physically irresponsible. The second thing that I wanted was I did not want our rookies, I did not want our new correctional officers to start their work life in segregation, because in my opinion, there's no more difficult place to work. The barrier was the seniority system. The seniority system allowed the most senior officers to choose where they worked in an individual prison. And we had this sort of odd, ironic situation. You had a group of officers at that time, now 25 or so years ago, who chose to be there and who wouldn't leave. It was a macho kind of thing, I thought. Though, in fairness to them, they felt a sense of duty about it and a sense of responsibility to other officers. But it just seemed to me sort of over the top in terms of how long they were there. But then you'd have slots that were empty that nobody wanted and tended to go to the most junior people. Those were the rookies, people coming into the system. So you had this odd and, I thought, unhealthy situation in which you had somewhat jaded people who had been there for too long, and you had rookies. And the rookies were learning the wrong kinds of things, it seemed to me, starting out in segregation. That's not the place you want them to learn to interact with either other staff members or with inmates.
In an April memo, current Department of Corrections Secretary Ed Wall expressed concern about whether we're using segregation improperly, using it for punitive reasons only. Other states are rethinking their use of it. Do you expect changes here in Wisconsin when it comes to segregation, solitary confinement?
Yeah, I think there are a couple things that one always wants to be looking at. One of them, I just go back to the mentally ill inmates to start. This is obviously a very unhealthy place for mentally ill people, because I think the likelihood that it worsens their condition is great. And secondly, you've obviously got the question of whether or not being there contributes to mental imbalance and to acting out and to psychosis. And so focusing in on the mentally ill and trying to find alternatives, not an easy thing to do, would be one place where I would start, although I'm not naive. It's not like the corrections people haven't been thinking about this. I think the problem for them probably is, what can we do with this difficult to manage population? There are only so many prisons and so many places they can go, and we don't have access to very much by way of where we can manage and hold them. Secondly, this question of who goes there and for what durations. I think the way it's usually worked in the prison system is people have been sent for relatively long durations, a year, long time, mm-hmm. but with the opportunity to get out, and they could sort of behave their way out. I don't know that anyone has really paid enough attention to figuring out better ways to help them behave their way out.
Gotcha. Walter, we have to leave it there for now. Thank
sure.
you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Yep.
That's Walter Dickey. He's professor of law at UW-Madison, former secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. 10 years ago, the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States issued the 9/11 Commission Report, which is the official account of the terrorist acts of the day. Now, a decade later, members of that commission have reconvened to issue a new report which looks at the changes to national security made in the last decade and outlines emerging threats to our nation and how we should be approaching them. The report argues that the struggle against terrorism is far from over and that it's entered a new and dangerous phase. Joining us now to discuss that report and its recommendations is Jamie Gorlick. She serves on the 9/11 Commission that issued this report and the one from 10 years ago. She's an attorney and former Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be with you.
So in terms of national security, how much progress has our country made in the last decade?
We found through our conversations with senior national security leaders and former leaders that we have made a lot of progress against core al-Qaeda, the folks who attacked us on 9/11, but there has been a proliferation of other groups and spin-offs. There are places in the world like Syria and Iraq that are offering both training and sanctuaries, And there are lone wolves, if you will, in the United States who we've seen can attack us and make us less safe. So our verdict, if you will, is that a tremendous amount of progress has been made by our government, but we are still in danger, and that the biggest threat to our national security is to become complacent about that danger.
I wanted to get into that point next. Are we getting complacent? I think the phrase counterterrorism fatigue comes up in your report.
Yes. We think that the American people are complacent and have been lulled into a sense of security by the fact that the government has protected us from a catastrophic attack over the last decade plus. But when you look at the objective threats, and when you talk to those whose job it is or has been to protect us, they are not at all sanguine.
Also, you warn, before we get into specific recommendations, you warn about the threat of cyber attacks in this report. How vulnerable are we?
We had individual conversations with these national security leaders, and one of the most striking things was that they agreed to a person that our cyber vulnerability is enormous. We see it in criminal hacking. We see it in attacks by nation states. We see it in the theft of intellectual property by nation states. Our country sits on a bed of interconnected infrastructure that is privately owned. And that privately owned infrastructure is the key to our own well-being and national security. That infrastructure is not being well protected because it is owned by the private sector, and the government and the private sector have not worked together effectively to harden those systems against attack.
A common theme for both of those threats, terrorism in the 21st century and cyber attacks, is their dispersed nature. There's not an enemy army sitting over there, and we've just got to keep an eye on that, or even one centralized Al-Qaeda leadership group that we have to watch out for. Have we adjusted our mindset to, as a national security institution, to meet that kind of dispersed threat?
I think that's a very good observation. There was a time when the President of the United States could ask the intelligence community, tell me who the bad actors in Al-Qaeda are and what you are doing to eliminate their threat to the United States. That is no longer a feasible mechanism for keeping us safe. What we need is a tremendous amount of intelligence about who is doing what the key bomb maker technologists are doing to evade our screening mechanisms, who is fighting in Iraq and Syria, who may have a European or U.S. passport, whether they are traveling, as they can easily do, back to the United States, what is happening to radicalize individuals in communities in the United States to take violent action, as Major Hassan did in the Fort Hood shootings, as the Sarnoff brothers did in the Boston Marathon bombing. These are much more difficult threats to combat because of their dispersed nature, and the same is certainly true in the cyber realm.
A lot of attention has been paid to how we collect information with a dispersed threat like that. Briefly, and we can get into it more later, are we collecting enough information to keep on top of those questions you just raised?
It really isn't possible for a group of private citizens, as we are, however schooled we may be in national security, to assess that. But we were struck by the mood of the country in the aftermath of the Snowden revelations, that a good chunk of our populace is more worried about the government spying on them than they are about the terrorist threat that might undermine our security. And in our view, that's a failure of our leadership to lead, to explain what the threat is, explain why we need in the government the authorities that are assertedly needed, and to put in place protections so that legitimate civil liberties concerns are addressed. When you listen to the debate, it seems quite one-sided and almost unreal if you know anything about what the threat actually is.
We'll follow up that point with Jamie Gorelick of the 9/11 Commission talking about a new report on national security out today. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where should the U.S. focus national security resources? What changes, good or bad, have you seen in the last decade? We're talking about the 9/11 Commission's report on national security issued today. They find while progress has been made in the last decade, the struggle against terrorism is far from over. There are serious threats, they say, to the country that need addressing. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where should the U.S. focus national security resources and efforts? Have you seen changes for the better or worse in the last 10 years? How could security be improved in the United States? Do you worry about the balance between security on the one hand and your privacy on the other? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jamie Gorelick is with us. She serves on that 9/11 commission. They issued this report and one from 10 years ago. She's an attorney, former Deputy Attorney General of the United States. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Harold on the line in Superior. Harold, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I think that we need to focus just a little bit, a wee bit, in the arena of why do people hate us? You think of mentally of all of the countries in the world, and how many of them have NSA? How many of them are as paranoid about being attacked? The reason has got to be that there's people that hate us. And why do they hate us?
Harold, thanks for the call. Jamie, so why is the U.S. particularly targeted? And are there public outreach efforts, diplomacy we could be doing to hopefully make people less prone to join up with terrorist organizations?
I would answer that question in two ways. One is the ideology underlying the folks who attacked us on 9/11 was, in essence, that there should be a religious state in which a very, very radical version of Islam would prevail, that we in the West, and not just the United States, but in the West, have values that with which they don't agree. So that's number one. Number two, there has been a reaction, for example, to our invasion of Iraq and our presence in Afghanistan. And one of the things that we said in the original 9/11 Commission report is that we should be showing the world as well our face of generosity. If you look at our popularity, for example, in a place like Indonesia, we were very unpopular. It's a Muslim country. There were many radical groups that had proliferated propaganda about us. After the tsunami hit, and we were a huge presence in providing aid and humanitarian assistance, that view of us changed. And so you have to use all the tools in your toolkit, including showing the best values of America.
Well, I want to get into some of the recommendations in the report out today. One thing is you'd like to streamline the way Congress oversees national security efforts. What are things like now? What do you want to see change?
We recommended in our initial report that the Department of Homeland Security, which has over 200,000 people, and many different missions, be overseen by a single committee of each house, in much the same way that the Defense Department is overseen by a single committee in each house, the House and the Senate. At that time, the Department of Homeland Security had 88 committees and subcommittees supervising and overseeing its work. Today, the Department of Homeland Security has 92 such committees. That is not effective and efficient. Anybody who runs anything, a family, a small business, a large business, a public interest organization, knows that you cannot run anything effectively if you have a multiple set of bosses. Well, this department has 92. That is not effective.
So the people in the department are spending a lot of time testifying, I imagine, before all these committees. But does that also mean that people on these 92 committees, they don't take responsibility? Maybe they don't provide the level of oversight that they should, since it's such a shared job?
Yes. If everyone is responsible, no one is responsible.
So
there's nobody who sees the whole picture and takes responsibility for the whole picture. If you're only responsible for oversight of the Coast Guard, you may do something or want to do something with respect to the Coast Guard that undermines what we're doing on border enforcement.
Another recommendation you have, updating the September 2001 authorization for the use of military force. What does that authorization still mean 13 years later? What do we need to change?
The premise of that authorization was that we were attacked by an enemy in Al-Qaeda and that we should use all necessary means to address that threat. Today, Al-Qaeda has splintered into many different groups. And operates in different environments, operates in Syria and Iraq and other places. And the thought is that it would be time for Congress to take a step back and decide exactly what it wants to authorize, as opposed to using a very old authorization that may not be as well suited as a current assessment would be.
One thing I wonder is, with a group like ISIS in Iraq and Syria, as horrific the things as it's doing are, they are threats in that region. We may not know, I don't know of them directly threatening the United States soil. How do we sort out where we take action against a group that is bad over there versus a threat over here?
That is a very, very good question. Certainly, if people in some faraway land are fighting each other, we may not have any stake in intervening in that fight. Indeed, there might be some dangers in doing so. However, one of the key observations of the original 9/11 Commission report was that if you have a power vacuum, if you have a feud such that a terrorist group can have a sanctuary in a country, as it did as Al-Qaeda did in Afghanistan, that can be a threat to the United States if the people in that sanctuary have the ultimate goal of attacking us here in the United States. So what we recommend is that we become much more vigilant about those who are fighting in Iraq and Syria to determine who might be there carrying a U.S. passport, carrying a European passport, who could very readily come to the United States and do us harm.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Madison. John, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, thank you very much for taking my call. The one thing that I don't think that is expressed by the administration is that a complete transparency of our security system, in other words, telling everybody everywhere everything we're doing to make this country secure, is national suicide. You just cannot do that. And there is the other problem surrounding that is that a particular party in power will try to make the other side look bad, even though they know they're just making stuff up. But complete transparency in our security system is just not practical.
John, thanks for the call. Jamie, a couple points I'd like to follow up on there. First of all, how far can we be transparent in what the government is doing on national security and counterterrorism without, as he says, committing national suicide?
The caller's observation is quite correct. I mean, one of the difficulties that national leadership, whether it be in the executive branch or the legislative branch, has in making the case to the American people that we need certain authorities is that if you talk about what you're doing in too much detail or what you need to be doing in too much detail, you reveal important evidence and information to your enemy. I think our view is there is a lot that could be said that would not have that effect. Complete transparency is obviously impossible, but we could be somewhat more transparent about the nature of the threat and, in general, what needs to be done to address that threat.
And John also alluded to differences between the parties, and the report cites that as part of our problem, a lack of bipartisanship on national security issues.
The number one obligation of a national government is to keep the people safe. And historically, that has meant that our partisan disagreements stop at our national borders, that our national security policy has to be set in the most bipartisan setting possible. And we agree with that. We would urge members of Congress to put aside their partisan differences and think about their very first responsibility, which is to keep us safe.
We'll leave it there for now. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to do so.
That's Jamie Gorelick. She's an attorney and former Deputy Attorney General of the United States. She serves on the 9/11 Commission. It's time for Teach Me What You Know. Each week we learn something new from experts around the world. Last week we found out how to explore a new city from a travel expert. This week we've got a physical therapy expert with us to teach us how to sit. Evan Johnson joins us now. He's an assistant professor and director of physical therapy at the Spine Center at the Columbia University Medical Center. Evan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, why is our posture when we're sitting so important?
You know, posture bears on so much of what we do and how we feel. What's important about it is to distribute stressors amongst the spine and posture in terms of how we sit and how we face the computer and how we interact with our environment so that we can be comfortable in life and not cause excessive strain.
Are we getting worse with our technology? And I'll say, you know, as I research this story, I'm kind of hunched in over my computer, maybe taking time to lean into my cell phone and text somebody. Are we worse thanks to our technology?
Indeed, we're worse. And it's not so much that any given posture is worse, but we tend to sustain it longer and repeat our tasks over and over again. So it's not just the posture that we're in and that we move through, but the postures we assume and stay in for long periods. And so in as much as we're sitting at a desk and sitting at a computer and sitting in front of iPhones and tablets, even when we're not at a computer, we are in repeating the task and the postures over and over again.
You know, I had thought of the physical impact of maintaining bad seated posture for a long time. You say, I gather, it means more than that. It has an emotional and maybe even a social impact in our lives.
Oh, indeed it does. And it comes from also emotional and social sources as well. If you think about, you know, an individual, maybe a young woman who develops early in life and kind of hides herself and crunches up a little bit because she's embarrassed or she's aware of attention she's receiving, or the response that we have to stress. When there's stress in our life, we tend to bring our shoulders together and kind of cover our throats a little bit, jut our chins forward. So it interacts very much with how we feel and also how the world perceives us.
Well, let's get to, that's the why. Let's get to some of the how now. What are the nuts and bolts? How do we assess our seated posture and figure out if we're doing it right?
Oh, that's a great question. So basically, we're looking for balance, and we're looking for balance in terms of static postures, how we're sitting and how we're leaning and so forth, but also dynamic postures. So to the extent that as we're seated, where we have the kind of natural curves in our spine, is that there's a slight curve forward in the low back and a slight curve backwards in the middle to upper back and a slight curve forward in the neck. And that balances us so our ears are placed over our shoulders and our shoulders are placed over our hips. So as a starter, that's a great position to be in as you work at your computer. Thinking about where the monitor is placed, if I have the monitor very low, I'm going to tend to look down and forward, or holding a tablet, of course, or an iPhone or some other mobile device, looking down and forward into my hand. So putting the device or the computer or the screen or whatever we're working with in a position where we can adopt a balanced posture as we look at it. And that's true even in terms of our seating posture. It's ideal to sit with the hips slightly higher than the knees, and the keyboard tray or the device that we're working with should be placed in such a position that we don't have to reach too far forward for it, right, or neither too far down or too far up.
So the answer is not sit ramrod straight.
It's not. Although, you know, sitting upright is positive, it's kind of an ideal reference point. But the real answer is variety. changing postures, moving dynamically. What evolution's really prepared us to do is to be active in life. And so there is this ideal reference point with these slight curves and this kind of balanced posture. I often refer to it, I think of it as like a string of beads. If you pick up a string of beads, the beads will fall in sequence underneath each other. That's how the spine behaves very much. If we're lifted up through our body somewhat and the trunk is lifted out of the pelvis, you'll see this alignment that occurs naturally. But just as important is to be dynamically mobile. NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, recommends frequent breaks. As a matter of fact, adding 4 5-minute breaks throughout your day can very much change our experience of the pain that we feel in our joints and our neck and our upper back.
Well, I'll confess to most of the sins you've described here. I'm, here at work, I'll zone in on something on the computer and realize I haven't moved in a long time. I'm perfectly capable of being addicted to a computer game, and I won't say how long I might go without moving then. How can we set ourselves to trigger that break you just mentioned, that it's time to get up and move?
That's a great question. And like a lot of things, like diet and other things in our life, there's a certain vigilance we have to keep. So there are some programs that are available that will flit across your computer screen and remind you to move or to stretch or to get up. There are new posture devices that one can connect to your spine or your trunk that vibrate. If you alter your posture too much or you stay in the same posture for too long, they'll vibrate on your skin, or they'll alert an app on your phone or your mobile device and tell you, oh, it's time that you move again, or look at where your posture is. So technology is now starting to monitor technology to some extent. But really the best solution is just kind of an awareness of how am I feeling at any given moment, and maybe I should move again, redistribute the fluids in the disc, redistribute the tension on my muscles. So ideally it's just the awareness and the vigilance.
So that's while we're seated at the desk or slumped over with our tablet or whatever. Are there warning signs we might watch out for? What kind of aches and pains might be a clue that we need to address our seated behavior?
Sure. I would say very much the extent to which you're seated and why you're seated, you have a repetitive feeling or a repetitive injury that occurs. So you notice after you're sitting at your computer for 2-3 hours, you notice, twice during the same week that you start getting a pain towards your elbow, or you start getting a pain in the back of your neck, or you start getting that nagging ache in your buttock, right? That's a sign. If that happens, and that happens 2 or 3 times in a week, that's a sign that you've really been sitting too long and you have to think about changing your behavior. The other one would be, if you start getting pain down the legs or into the fingertips, that's often a sign of a pinched nerve. Pinched nerve in the neck will cause pain into the hands, or in the back will cause pain into the legs. And that's telling you it's really time to move and to be active and get out of your seat.
I know as part of your daily gig, you watch people who have had spinal surgery or have serious problems, but you watch them. You watch for warning signs of bad posture-related behavior. What tips you off when they're in your office?
Sure. Well, some of the things that tip you off is right away as they're sitting, if they move into a posture, that kind of slouch posture, the behind turns under and the back is in a big C curve and slouched into the chair and the head starts to jut forward right away, and they stay there and they remain there for, as you're interviewing them or as you see them sitting in the waiting room, right away that tips you off. Then you see the kind of rubbing the neck, right? Or you see a little, lifting of the buttock. They kind of shift their weight onto one sit bone, off the sit bone. All of that tells you that there are areas of pressure and areas of discomfort that they're trying to avoid.
Now, you mentioned a couple technological tips, reminders that give us messages to get up and move from time to time. Are there simple things we can do with, pillows or braces or those weird things people put on their necks on airplanes? Is any of that helpful?
Sure, it is helpful. Braces may be less so in kind of very common usage, although there's places for them with specific injuries. But more to the extent would be, how do you maintain that balance that we mentioned? So typical lumbar cushions, which are available all over the place, pretty much at every drugstore online, they're just small cushions that fit into the small of your back and help you keep an arch in your back. Those are wonderful. The pillows that fill the small arch forward in your neck that you use on an airplane are also fine, but you don't even need to bring a pillow. You could take a small towel, or you could take your sweatshirt and you can roll it up. But again, as much as those things are important, variety is so important. So being in a position maybe on the aisle seat or a bulkhead or somewhere you can shift around, move your legs, get up. Even if you stand up at your desk, you stand up and you look at your computer screen for 15 seconds and walk around your desk and sit back down, you've changed the tension on the muscles and you've redistributed fluid and tissues in your body, and it's a very healthy thing to do.
Now, generations of children have grown up with the message, don't slouch while sitting or standing, I guess. Obviously, that hasn't gotten through to all of us. What are good ways to communicate to kids the importance of paying attention to their posture?
Great question. With two adolescent boys who are, you know, somewhat slightly addicted to all kinds of technology, it's a question I face in my personal life as well as professional life. Really, the question is, how do you convince somebody, how do you show them a rationale that it matters? Sometimes the best way is to appeal to vanity. Sometimes the sense of getting, of saying, oh, look how you look. You know, I mean, if a young person's at a school dance, right, they're not going to slouch if they want to be attractive to the person next to them or someone across the way. They'll sit up, they'll present a certain way. So sometimes just kind of showing them a picture of how they look, right, or putting a mirror, a small mirror on your monitor so they can see themselves, right? Little things like that. But
so you're trying to make your teenagers more self-conscious?
Oh, indeed. without criticizing their body image, okay, which is a fair question. But the consciousness about posture, you know, that's a way to attempt it. And honestly, it's not an easy task to convince someone who's not in pain that they should change their posture because someday they may be in pain. It's kind of like telling somebody, you know, if you eat certain foods, you may someday have hypercholesterol, and it'll mean that you have heart disease. It's a hard thing to convey unless it's kind of a national message that we convey.
Well, sell us on it. Give us a message of how much better our lives will be in the short and long run if we do start taking this seriously and not sitting stock still in bad posture for hours on end.
I think that's a great question. You know, as we're staying active as a society, we're living longer, we're active as we're older. I see compilations of all kinds of musculoskeletal conditions that really take away the quality of life for individuals, and you see them as early as middle age or in young people. And so the idea is, if you're vibrant and you're active and your body projects good health through good posture, it's just a quality of life issue, and you'll end up less likely to have all kinds of conditions.
And we're hearing a lot of studies saying overall we should be sitting less than we do. That's important too?
Indeed, sitting less and moving more. So even if we sit, getting up frequently, moving more, and be having more dynamic lives, there are also things like desks that go up and down, right? Hydraulic desks where you can stand at work and sit at work, or laptops that attach to treadmills. There's a million technological advances, but if we move our bodies, which is what we've been designed to do over, you know, millions of years of tailoring, if we move our bodies, then essentially we're staying healthier.
Evan, thanks so much. And even before this interview, I've tried to start doing the things you're recommending. So thanks for the advice.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Evan Johnson. He's assistant professor and director of physical therapy at the Spine Center in the Columbia University Medical Center. And this week's Teach Me What You Know, he taught us how to sit.